I'll call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum, even though it doesn't look like it, at the table here, because many legislators are trying to be more than one place, and they're coming and going. So, Representative Benson, would you move the March 25th minutes?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the March 25th minutes, please.
Representative Benson moves the March 25th minutes. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes, motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Representative McFarland, April 9th minutes.
I move the approval of the April 9th.
McFarland moves approval of the April 9th minutes. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And the April 9th minutes are approved. So now, our one item on the agenda today is House File 4178. We don't have a clever number like 1812, and that doesn't matter because we're not going to keep this number next year when we introduce it. We can, unless I'll advocate to be House File 1 next year, because we've got this bill ready and it should be number 1. I would like to thank the task force members who worked on this plan from late fall up until just last week when we're still looking at changes in it. And I'm sorry that they're not all here, but Representative Dabney, Representative McFarland, Representative Morrow, I think Representative McFarland is the only one here of the ones that were appointed, and then Representative Heidgerken, an ex-officio member being the lead Republican at the time, and we also wanted to balance out rural representation on our committee. So we appreciate that he hung with us and I think made it to all the meetings as well. And then in the Senate, of course, we worked with Senator Bonas and her team, and they have introduced the bill in the Senate as well. And then we worked with Commissioner Alice Segrin, who we went over the bill with her and Tom Melcher and our staff last week, and I believe she likes it quite well. I just talked to her again about it last night when we had our hearing in St. Cloud, and but she hasn't gotten any kind of a green light at all from Governor Pawlenty about the bill. One of the reasons that we, and we're going to go through the bill, Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow are going to go through it so we can understand it and ask questions. And then we have several people that will testify. And we have sessions in at 11 a.m., so we're definitely going to have to stop at 10:45 if we're not done with testifiers by then. Now I lost what I was going to say. Finish up by 11, that wasn't it. Well, anyway. It'll maybe come to me, maybe not, but anyway, okay. I was going to make a point. That's really maddening. In any case, we'll have hearings in the interim during the interim at different parts of the state. So we'll have explain to the public what we have here, and then get input. It will be a work in progress. In fact, there's even an amendment in your packet. That's a result of the meeting with Mr. Belcher and Commissioner Segrin with some technical type changes that we won't actually make today because we're not sending the bill anywhere. It can't be incorporated. But those changes will probably be some of many changes that we're looking at next year. It's a dynamic process, and we want people's input. So, Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow, if you could... before that, maybe this is maybe not what I was going to say, but it's something I want to say, and that is to thank the PS Minnesota group that we have the testifiers that chaired the first two Education Finance Committees, Mr. Dressen and Mr. Vandell. It was the work that those groups did that enabled this bill to be put together. So thank you very much, Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, Mr. Crow and I will go through the bill and the printouts for you. Just so we're clear that we're working off the similar documents, the The bill is House File 4178. There'll be a technical amendment that'll be passed around in a little bit here. And then there's been a couple of changes on the printout, and I'm not sure, I guess, from the date stamp on this one, if it's got the latest version of the printout in the folder. The only thing that changed on the printout was the location equity index. The language in the bill, and we'll talk about this when we get to the bill, says that the index number that should be used is the highest index number for any county for which the school district quarter is in. And we'll just double check on the printout to make sure we've got the right one there. This only affected a handful of districts. And but with that said, Madam Chair, the printout is laid out on the 14-inch paper, and we'll go through that after we run through the bill for you real quick. Madam Chair, members, there are a couple of different parts to the bill. We'll just, I think, go through these in section order very quickly for you. One of the sets of changes that will appear in a few places is the equalizing factors for a variety of formulas are set to the to key off of the statewide adjusted net tax capacity equalizing factor. Essentially, these changes bump up the aid ratio in a variety of the formulas. The first of these in Section 1 is for the debt service formula. This is similar to a provision that was in the bill last year, and the changes on page 1 and page 2 in Section 1 essentially increase the aid and decrease the levy for the debt service equalization program. The second section is also from last year's bill and has to do with the treatment of agricultural property in cases when a debt election is held. This is the school bond agricultural credit. This essentially has the state pay for through a credit for a bunch of the costs of a school debt levy that falls on agricultural property. The technical amendment on line 2.12 will change the 20% to 66%. So essentially, 66% of the of any debt levy that falls against ag property will be paid by the state, and the remaining 33% would then be paid by that property. Section 3, Madam Chair, is simply the equalizing factor for the health and safety levy, bumping that up to 100% as well. Section 4 is a section that the department had some concerns and suggestions for. This provision is from Representative Faustin Benson's proposal that would essentially just say that any district can do deferred maintenance without going to the voters. The department suggested that perhaps this should be combined with the next section, the deferred maintenance section, and have health and safety revenue thrown in as well and have a total allowance there so that the department wouldn't have to go through the process it currently does on health and safety. I'll leave it to the committee to discuss that, but essentially the change that is being considered here would be to essentially take health and safety and deferred maintenance, combine them together, and put them on a per-pupil formula, maybe somewhere in the neighborhood of a $600 formula. So on line 3.25, instead of that being raised to $100, would be $600, and then the alternative facilities and deferred maintenance and health and safety would all be combined. Madam Chair, the next section is simply the equalizing factor for the deferred maintenance levy, increasing that to the 100% of the statewide average equalizing factor, which currently is about $7,500 per pupil. The next change on Section 7 has to do with pupils of limited English proficiency. There's a couple of changes to this program. Three, in fact, the formula amount is changed in a later section. Secondly, the concentration part of the formula is eliminated. And then third, the change that's here is the five-year cap is eliminated from the pupil count from the pupils of limited English proficiency. The next section, Section 8, is the change in the formula. Right now, a school district is eligible for $700 in basic LEP revenue and up to an extra $250 in concentration revenue. This would replace those two formulas with a single formula that's equal to 20% of the formula allowance revenue for that year. The formula allowance in the bill is $7,500, so essentially we'd be taking 20% of that number instead of the 700 plus up to 250. The next two changes, Madam Chair, have to do with special education revenue. These would complete the direction that the legislature went last year and essentially would uncap the formula so that the special education and excess cost formulas would be funded at the 68% amount specified in statute. pardon me, so these two sections eliminate the statewide cap on special education funding. They keep in place the formula that keeps off the percent of 68% of the employee's salary, but they take off the statewide cap. The next section simply defines the statewide equalizing factor that's going to be used in various places instead of the individual equalizing factors that are currently there. Section 12 defines the location equity index. The department made some suggestions for cleaning up the way that this index is calculated, but essentially what this does is it provides an index number for each school district based on the portion of the school district. If you look at line 620 through 622, whatever portion of the school district is in a county with the highest number is the number that's used. Under our current data for the location equity index, those districts that have an index greater than 1 are currently in counties located in the metropolitan area, with the highest index number being 112% for Hennepin County, 111% for Carver County, 110% for Scott County, and Washington County, and 108% for Ramsey County, I believe. So those index numbers are for each of the metropolitan counties. If a district is located in a county in greater Minnesota, if its location equity index got above 1, that district would also then qualify for location equity index revenue. The next couple sections, Madam Chair, have to do with pupil units. Essentially on page 7, on line 715 through 21, you can see that the pupil unit weightings are changed to 1.0 for all pupils. This has a couple of major effects. First, it makes full-day kindergarten fully funded. Secondly, it eliminates the difference between the adjusted marginal cost pupil count and the adjusted pupil count by just simply counting each pupil as 1.0. So we'll have fewer pupils under this new system, fewer funding pupils. They'll all be weighted at 1.0. The next change in Section 14, Madam Chair, has to do with compensatory revenue, and a couple of major changes happen here. First of all, the index would be calculated now at the district level instead of at the building level. The goal of this change was to make sure that there were no incentives for school districts to concentrate children in one building, as the index would be on a district level. Secondly, a minimum is put in that's at a fairly high level, so that each free and reduced lunch student would count at a minimum of $2,500 per pupil. This shows up in a second section here, but the effect of that essentially is to limit the concentration. The concentration then grows from that $2,500 per pupil only up to $3,000 per pupil, depending on the district's concentration. So much, much narrower spread in concentration because of the relatively high minimum in compensatory revenue. The next change in sections 15 and 16 are simply conforming to the pupil wage change and taking out the declining pupil aid as a part of the pupil count. Instead, there's a separate component of general education that's added that includes that. Section 17 is average daily membership, and this has to do with the extended time or summer school funds for school districts. Essentially, this section says that you don't get any extended time revenue until your school has served the children the number of hours that are essentially the statewide number of hours per grade for those grades. So, in other words, an elementary student would need to have 960 hours of regular instruction before they generate any time for an extended time. Section 18 is a corresponding change for the compensatory revenue that clarifies that it's done on a district basis now instead of a building basis. Section 19 is the LEP changes that we talked about earlier. Section 20 is a section that the department suggested wasn't necessary. This is some framework language that the PS Minnesota report had suggested, that perhaps we try and move our system toward one where we could group expenditures or revenues in a framework that talks about general classroom funding, district instructional services, and district support services. I think we may want to discuss that a bit more, but essentially the issue here is trying to keep things simple and not have two structures of general education revenue. Section 21, then, is the definition of general education revenue. Section 22 sets the basic formula allowance Two things happen here. On line 12.12, the basic allowance is set at $7,500 per pupil, compared to the current allowance of $5,124 per pupil. This is two things. One, it's a large increase of the current formula amount, but it also reflects the change in the pupil weighting, with fewer pupil units now per district because of the 1.0 weighting. A larger allowance is needed to bring the same amount of money. So it's the two things going on there. And then secondly, on line 12.14, the formula allowance would not be a static amount, but rather would be increased each year by the growth of an implicit price deflator, so that regardless of legislative action, essentially the formula would be going up each year. Section 23 sets extended time revenue equal to the formula allowance instead of the formula allowance for fiscal year 2005, so it becomes a linked formula like compensatory in LEP and sparsity. Section 24 is the new declining pupil enrollment. This replaces the weighting on pupils by essentially using a three-year average. A school district then would essentially get the formula allowance times the difference between its three-year average pupil count and its current pupil count. This wouldn't affect a growing school district, but for school districts with decline, we'd be measuring their current pupil count against the three-year average pupil count and funding the difference at the formula allowance. Section 25 is the formula for the location equity revenue. It's set at 50% of the formula allowance. The district times the district's pupil count for that year. Section 26 is a new component of general education revenue that tries to reduce the spread in referendum revenue. This is similar to the 415 roll-in of a few years ago, and before that, the provision that Representative Bowerly had placed in the school finance law. What this does is it takes away $500 of every district's referendum revenue, replaces it with $500 of revenue here. So if a district doesn't have any referendum revenue, they pick up the $500. A district that had $500 of referendum revenue loses that equalized aid and levy and instead picks up all state aid under this provision. So the idea is essentially to pull in the referendum authority, reduce the spread in referendum authority amongst school districts. Section 27 is the revenue element for compensatory revenue. You can see here that the minimum is put in on line 13.22. Each school district is guaranteed at least $2,500 per student who's eligible for free or reduced price lunch. Then the concentration kicks in and would bring a district up to 40% of the formula allowance for those that at a maximum concentration level. With a $7,500 formula allowance, that 40% pulls them up to about $3,000. So the range in compensatory is fairly substantially narrowed between high concentration and low concentration districts. Section 28 is simply eliminating the LEP concentration revenue. Section 29 is the sparsity revenue section. There's on the technical amendment here, you'll see that there are two other references to the 19 miles that get fixed. The idea is that the qualifying elementary school would be only 15 miles to the next nearest in order to qualify for sparsity instead of the 19 miles. The change in section 30 on line 23 adjusts the operating capital revenue so that it's about the same amount as is currently existing. The change in pupil weighting lowered operating capital. This pushes it back up to about the same total dollar amount, so that district's operating capital revenue is essentially unaffected. The next change in section 31 and 32 has to do with some pupil transportation costs. Transportation sparsity revenue is kept and is continued to be linked to the formula, but then two other transportation formulas are added. In paragraph C, starting on line 16.21, a school district receives additional transportation aid for hazardous pupil transportation. That's limited to not more than 20% of the district's regular to and from school transportation costs. And then all school districts in paragraph B on line 1630 would receive 5% of the district's total transportation spending as an amount equal to a bus purchase amount. For those districts that don't contract for bus purchases, or they could use that for bus purchases. For those who do contract for bus services, they can use that money for a different purpose. But essentially, each district would be getting 5% of its transportation spending, essentially for the capital cost of buses. Section 33, Madam Chair, is the innovation revenue provision. This essentially requires the school district to use revenue that's set aside under Section 35, a portion of that for innovative purposes. If a district's student growth in academic performance is not at a sufficient level, then the district needs to file a plan with the commissioner about how it's going to spend its innovation revenue, and can't spend that revenue until the commissioner has approved its plan, and then spend it only for the purposes of that plan. Section 34 essentially eliminates some of the levies that have crept back into the general ed program, so the operating capital, equity transition levies are all eliminated. General education essentially becomes all aid again. Section 35 are the set-asides. Some of the formulas that are eliminated, like the money for gifted and talented, instead of having a separate formula to calculate it, becomes a separate set-aside. So the new set-asides include 1% of the formula allowance for gifted and talented, 1.5% of the formula allowance for innovative revenue programs, 0.5% of the revenue must be added to the career and technical levy. That levy remains, but that amount would be added to it. And then the basic skills revenue, the LEP and compensatory, is still reserved for the purposes for which it's currently reserved, as is operating capital. The technical amendment will also make a cross-reference here. The staff development reserve remains at 2% under this bill, but it will put it in this list, too, so that it's clear that it's ongoing. Section 36 has to do with the referendum revenue and reflects that the referendum levies are being reduced by $500 for each school district. Section 37 is the open and standing appropriation for general education, and this adds to that the special education aid, the debt service aid, and the school bond agricultural credit. So instead of having a line item appropriation for these three each year, they would simply be open and standing like general education. If their costs are greater than what's estimated, it would come straight from the Treasury. If the costs are less, the amount would never be appropriated. Section 38 are some changes to the building lease. First of all, on line 19.16, you can see that the administrative purposes are added so that if a school district wants to lease administrative space, it can do so. Currently, it's limited to instructional space. And then secondly, on the next page, the amounts are increased. The regular lease levy for school districts on line 20.18 is increased from $100 to $150 per pupil. And on the next page, on line 1 of page 21, the portion that a member of an intermediate school district may lease is increased from $25 to $50 per pupil. Finally, Madam Chair, the revisor's instruction instructs the revisor to go through the statutes and clean up all of our pupil references so that they refer to adjusted pupil units and resident pupil units instead of having the marginal cost of pupil units in them. And then in Section 40, Madam Chair, is the repealer. The repealers are listed in the bill summary, and you can see that the portions of general education that are being repealed include the gifted and talented revenue, the levy portion of operating capital, equity is being eliminated, transition is being eliminated. Under this version of the draft, the QComp revenue is being eliminated. The set-aside for the learning and development or the class size reserve are being eliminated. And the teacher retirement and TERA adjustments are being eliminated. And the result of that elimination, for those school districts that are members of TRA, they essentially have a negative adjustment for their general education revenue totaling about $30 million. That amount is eliminated. So, Madam Chair, that's what the repealers are that are listed. And that's a quick summary of what's in 4178.
Thank you, Mr. Crow, or Mr. Strom, I mean. Mr. Crow, then, are you going to go through the spreadsheet?
Madam Chair, thank you.
He's going to go, Mr. Strong.
the general education revenue spreadsheet that you have in front of you is available for us to email folks the file if they like. The portion that you've got here is a district-by-district printout. We also have this in a lookup table format so that you can put in your own district number and see how each of the changes has affected your particular school district. The way this printout is laid out, the pupil count, the new pupil count of pupils is shown in the first column of data. This is all, by the way, shown on fiscal year 2009 data, although obviously the first year of implementation wouldn't be 2009. But to use data that's as solid as possible, we use the fiscal year 2009 data. The first column then shows the basic general education revenue without a referendum for each school district, and then that amount on a per pupil basis. And if you look at the top line, you can see the statewide average or total for that amount, and then the next line down shows the 5th and 95th percentile, how far the spread is between the bottom and the top. You can look up and down the list at your districts and see how they compare on basic general education revenue. Then the next column shows the referendum revenue, $724 million of referendum revenue, or $881 on average. And you can see how that varies by district. And then general ed and referendum are added together in the next column called baseline total general education revenue of $6.53 billion, or $7,945 per pupil. So that's essentially the baseline. Then the next six columns show these same amounts for the proposal, the alternative that's here. You can see the general ed levy, or general ed revenue rather, is increased from $5.8 billion to $7.969 billion. The referendum revenue has dropped slightly more than half, from $724 million to $314 million. And then the total general education has gone, including referendum, has gone from $6.5 billion to $8.2 billion, with the amount per pupil now averaging $10,074. And then the last three columns show three different measures of how you could measure the increase over base. And the first of those is total dollar increase over base. The second is the dollars per pupil over base, and then the third is the percentage. Some districts are going to look better on the dollars per pupil if their base is smaller. Other districts, if their base is bigger, other districts, because if they start from a smaller base, the percentage increase may be bigger than the state average. So those are three different measures to compare those on. And contrary to my earlier remark, I think the date of the printout is all that is different. It is the printout that reflects the change in the LEI, so that it does reflect those 18 school districts that have a portion of their district in a different county. So I apologize for the confusion on that, but this is essentially the most recent version of the printout. And then, as I said, Madam Chair, for each individual district, this file is available, and people can put in the district number on a lookup table, generate a little report that shows how much additional compensatory or LEP the district got, how much change in referendum the district got. So each of these components can be analyzed on a district basis.
And Mr. Strom, is all available to the public as well?
Madam Chair, right now we need to email that file out, but we're hoping to put that up on the website pretty quick here so that people can just click on the link.
And that will be the department website?
No, Madam Chair. This is the House.
The House website. Okay, very good. Okay, before we go to questions, I just want to say that I like to liken this bill to the Eiffel Tower, and we can fund it according to scale. And what we're interested in are two things as we go forward with this debate. One of them is the Eiffel Tower, which could sit right here on my desk, or it could be the real Eiffel Tower, depending upon how much money we put into it. I want the real Eiffel Tower, and probably others want the one that sits here right on my desk. So we have to figure out if we have the Eiffel Tower built properly so that the length of every single piece of it is artistic and fair and equitable. That's our job in this committee next year, and we'll be getting input, like I said, all during the interim. And then we also have to work with the tax committee to figure out, and we'll also look at the forecast in the economy next year, But I believe we'll also, in addition to that, be working with the tax committee to decide how big is the Eiffel Tower and how long does it take us to build it. You know, you could build this Eiffel Tower over 10 years, and then instead of $2,500 for each compensatory student, it would be $250 for each compensatory student. Or we could do it over three bienniums. That's kind of what I envision, three bienniums. I'd love to go faster. But other states that have done this have taken about that amount of time. But that, those will be our two decisions. One, do we have the pieces right? There's something in here for everybody to love and everybody to hate. And some might think, well, I'm going to get all my pieces, but I'll get rid of that piece or that piece. But I would submit that then the Eiffel Tower will not stand up. It's only with this whole thing in here that we are able to go forward with the discussion of how big to make the Eiffel Tower. Now, there might be some pieces that we need to change as we go forward, because PS Minnesota's report, while very good, the task force did make some changes in it because it didn't stand up with a couple of their suggestions. And people may find that the task force has some inartistic pieces as well, or ratios of how they fit in. But this whole formula is linked so that once we get it right and we go forward with funding it, we won't have these end runs of one piece trying to run out and get bigger and another piece is atrophying. They're all linked. So it is very important that we have that discussion of how they fit together. And then, of course, the bigger discussion of how to fund it and how fast to go. But I'm proud of at least the initial little Eiffel Tower that we have here. And I'm hoping that we will be looking, if we need tax increases, and I think that we do, for the adequacy that we need, that it would be progressive taxes. Right now, we have so many property taxes going into the school funding that it's, and some cannot pass their levies. We all know that on this committee, that we have to do something besides local property taxes. And anytime we try to equalize those, it's property tax relief, not money to schools. So this is based on all money to schools as much as possible. It's 85% state funding instead of the 78% that we're at right now. Questions from members? Representative Demmer, Heidrichsen, and then Erickson. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So there's
good morning.
I was looking at Representative Detmer and wondering why did he keep writing when I called his
well,
name.
You know, Madam Chair, we have Emmer, Detmer, Demmer. So you know, that's logical that you would have that. Thank you. Good, bad, in between. We need to get this out and get it better. And I'm going to start at 50,000 feet, and I'm not going to go to which taxes or, you know, whatever. I'm not going to go there yet, Madam Chair. My question is very broad-based. I there's lots of things being dealt with here, and like you said, we can get into the minutiae of I like this piece, don't like that piece, whatever. I understand you get a package here.
Mm-hmm.
From 50,000 feet, Madam Chair, how is this going to handle the issue of declining enrollment in some districts and give them, other than just pouring more money in, which is one of the things, but how is this going to handle the issue of declining enrollment and in reference and in comparison to and taking care of their needs and the things that they need to fund, and I'm thinking fixed cost versus variable cost here type of thing, without being a windfall to those who are growing in enrollment? In other words, you get some schools declining and some schools gaining. How will this overall handle that fairly without just being a windfall to the growing district? They have more, they're awash in money while we're trying to hold up the districts that are declining. That would be kind of my overall general question to begin with, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, Representative Demmer, as you, I'm sure you heard, as Mr. Strom went through the bill, there is a three-year averaging portion for decline enrollment district. Right now they have just the 1 year, and so going forth, if, when we fund this bill, it will be three-year averaging, so they get to average their, you know, the 3 years, and that will give them a better continuum as they lose enrollment, because we all know you don't just lose costs when you lose students. Believe it or not, as far as the growing district, one of the suggestions that came from the Senate was to give them extra money as they were growing beyond this, because surely they needed more money to accommodate for their growing needs. And I think they may be going to bring that in, so it will be part of the discussion. But those of us in the House felt they already get a lot more money just by their extra students, and that was, it sounds like you're concerned that that might even be rewarding them too much, and so you might want to talk to the senators who are on this group. Senator Cook, I think, was the one interested in that. But beyond that, that's what we've done in this bill, and we certainly could be open to other suggestions if you have some, and that's why we do want to have these hearings, because you know, that's where the good suggestions often come from. It's when people look at what we have and then they build on it.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. If I could, and you're right, that's what we have to do, look at. You know, we don't want to be in a position where we're punishing schools that are growing. Obviously, they need to have revenues and they need to have funds coming in too. But typically, schools grow for reasons other than just money. There are other factors. It could be location. It could be the economic conditions of what's happening around them. And they need to have funding for those. And that's fine. I'm just saying we don't want to take away from those things. But on the other hand, we don't want to increase the number of reasons that there would be maybe for a school to grow at the expense of maybe schools that are declining for reasons beyond their control. And that I think is the, and I think feathering in over a period of time like that makes some sense, averaging, if you will, makes some sense. But I was just curious from a broad-based perspective what your thinking was there. So thank you.
Yeah, Rep. Demmer, thank you. And that was, you know, that's what's in the bill. One of the things that we were charged by the statute last year was to look at efficiencies and more regional cooperation. And we did take some good suggestions, and we did not, however, end up putting any in this bill by the time we got to actually looking at them, thinking they were things that districts could already do with us not changing any laws. But that's the portion that I'll be especially attuned to. If there's anything that needs a state statute to do or to encourage or whatever, that might address that issue too. But we did, we ended up thinking that we've done about most of the consolidation that can be done. We had a lot of support on our committee for small schools and the fact that they could do well in them. So we didn't want to just, you know, we were looking at how to help small schools more than try to do something about it, even though they had a lot of declining enrollment. Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Can I ask one more question?
Okay.
And this is different.
One more question, and now we're going to take Representative Heidrick and Erickson. We do have one of the technical amendments that we'll then do, and as soon as we get the second one, we're going to do it. And then I'll go back to Representative Garofalo, and then we're going to start with our testifiers, and legislators can ask questions after that. Representative Demmer.
Reform, Madam Chair. I know we're reforming the funding.
Mm-hmm.
Are we reforming anything else?
Representative Demmer, we are charged. Our charge was to reform the funding and not the whole education system. But we did, however, work very closely with Representative Mariani and the policy committee that's more charged with the policy vision, which we believe that should be what our funding is for, not just, you know, a ton of money. What are we trying to do in our schools, and let's fund that? And so his committee has been looking, you know, PS Minnesota looked at what does it cost to pass the tests that we have nationally and in our state. And we broadened the vision through his committee to look at, you know, that new report card that we have, and that's why we have the innovation revenue in here, which is a small section of the bill, but it is huge because a portion of the money that districts get, and we can talk about that portion if we don't have it right, 1.5%, districts only get if their kids are making value-added growth due to that new report card. If they are not getting it, they have to come up with a plan, and we've talked with the University of Minnesota, we've talked with Growth and Justice, and there are you know, ways to help districts know what is research-based, what would help them to learn, so that they can come up with plans so their kids can make value-added growth that are approved by the department. And so, you know, that 1.5% could be talked about. If that's enough to incent that behavior, that was the consensus of our group. But I you know, would be open to making that a larger portion. That's the major reform in this bill, and if you have more suggestions for a vision that should be reflected in financing, you're all ears. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question and then a comment. Mr. Strum would correct me. When I'm looking at the spreadsheets here, I don't think we're seeing all of the numbers. I don't know if the alternative facilities aid's in here. I don't know if the integration aid is in here. I don't know if all the special ed monies are in here. Are those pockets of money not in here, and what else is not in here?
Madam Chair, Representative Heidgerken, very good question. The printout that you have in front of you deals only with the general education revenue. On the special education front, we were waiting for a little bit better data. We're very concerned, as you may know, and in fact, you heard at the hearing last night, there's a lot of concern about the current year funding of special education and what the numbers are actually showing. So we thought we'd avoid the controversy on that by not showing the change. Essentially, by eliminating the proration on special education, it's about a 88% proration factor. So school districts could, for the current year, essentially could expect 12% more. It'd be across the board because of the way the proration works, essentially, or pretty much across the board. So essentially, take the amount of current special education, which we're having trouble showing, mm-hmm. and up that by about 12%. Secondly, on the alternative facilities, that's another very, very good point. We don't have a good guess of who will be doing what in terms of deferred maintenance, and that's part of why the department made the suggestion to go to a fixed formula amount of, for example, $600 per pupil of combined health and safety and deferred maintenance, because we know that number will vary a great deal by school district, but we really don't have a sense of whether the large districts that currently qualify for alternative facilities, if they're the model that other districts will follow, or if other districts will have relatively smaller costs than that. But we're going to look at some square footage, cost per square footage models, some age models, and see if we can't get a better estimate of that. But that's not showing up here. Then in terms of all of the other categorical formulas, except for the ones that were specifically mentioned, those other formulas still exist. So, for example, the secondary vocational levy still exists, the integration revenue still exists, the community education formula still exists. I think those are the main ones out there. The safe schools levy, for example, would still exist. And then the smaller levies like the ice arena levy and swimming pool levy, those things are untouched by this document as well.
And Rep. Heidgerken, you know that things are, unless it's being changed, it doesn't show up in the bill. And unless it's quantified, it doesn't show up in the spreadsheet. But you know that the alternative facilities levy is in the bill. The special ed is in the bill. And the alternative facilities levy is now an opportunity, along with deferred maintenance, districts can have their choice because the latter is equalized and the former is not. But it's not just for the 21 large districts. None of us have ever liked the alternative facilities levy. We all represent districts that don't qualify. So we're trying to put it on an even playing field. And then because some have property wealth and some do not, we've put in Rep. Marquardt's bills from last year, Rep. Welty's debt service equalization, and Rep. Shumpers, I think that was Rep. Demers as well. Then the ag credit that many worked on, those are in here so that when districts do levy, they have an evener shot of being able to fund those things.
I just have one question to make sure we get everybody understands what's here and what's not, and when you start spinning out the numbers on, if you would throw all those monies within each of the school districts, you would see some drastic different numbers in front of us. But point being, I just want to follow up with Representative Demers' comments in regards to what's not in here. And I think Representative Crowley and you and I have had that conversation. We have taken care of the... when I look at this, we've taken care of the suburban areas quite well. When you look at the percentages, they do quite well. So the regional centers tend to do quite well. And at the same time, we see school districts that are growing. Actually, probably are doing quite well in this as well. We see schools that we see sparsity money that are doing quite well with the numbers here. the school districts that are falling behind, whether it be Representative Brown's district or mine or whomever, Representative Anzell, where we're seeing a problem is what Representative Demmer addressed, declining enrollment. And Representative Demmer, the piece that I, and I, Representative Greiling and I have had the conversation in the task force, the piece I would like to see reinstated is the T&E. We used to have teacher experience, which would take care of that declining enrollment. I've got 13 school districts, Representative Greiling. Everyone is fighting for not less kids, but for more kids. We have an open enrollment problem. That is the problem. I have one school district that's growing that does not have any of the problems that the other 12 have. That's the one fortunate one I have. I have 12 unfortunate ones. They're all declining. What we need more than ever, if you're out in a declining school district, and I think there's some in the suburbs also, is when you have a declining enrollment, you're not adding faculty. You're cutting faculty. You go out to all the school districts and their SOD, they're cutting faculty, and they're cutting faculty with very little experience. So the experience mod goes up. And years ago, we used to take care of that. You got a high experience factor. You have a higher cost in your classroom. And classrooms pick up, salaries pick up 85% of the money that's budgeted to you. That would be, I think we put T&E in here, you're going to see all of your school districts come up closer to each other. And I think that's the only thing that's really missing. We've had that discussion.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Heidrick, and I appreciate that. And, you know, we put in the three-year average in instead of that, but we can continue to discuss that. And as for, I don't think there's maybe anybody left here that fought that battle with me back when I was, Representative Mariani. We both fought that battle in our early days in the legislature, and believe it or not, we lost. We were for it, and it was something that at that time was portrayed as kind of a metro-rural thing. So it's just fascinating to me that Representative Heidrichen is now advocating for it. I told him if he were here in the early 90s, he would have voted against it. He said, no, he wouldn't have. But in any case, we will continue discussing that, and that is what we want to find out. What are the weak points in this bill if we're not treating some type of district fairly? So we're now going to do Representative Erickson, and then we'll go to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question is, does the spreadsheet suggest that there's full implementation in the coming biennium?
Representative Erickson, yes, this is our pie in the sky. If we got everything our hearts desired and the tax committee helped us and or the economy helped us. So if we only do a tenth of it, you have to factor down, you know, take off the rest.
So, Madam Chair, I think it's important when you have the interim hearings that if this spreadsheet is handed out, that the folks who attend the hearing know that this is the top of the Eiffel Tower, or whatever your tower looks like, so that there's not misunderstanding, because I think this could breed a huge amount of misunderstanding. Secondly, Madam Chair, what happened to quality compensation or some kind of performance pay?
Representative Erickson, that's the $64,000 question for today, because this draft does not put it in, or it takes it out, because we're giving out so much extra money that we were trying to simplify the formula and have less little pots. And that's one, as you know, that's a grant program that some districts get and some districts do not. So we didn't put it in. When we met with Commissioner Segrin, she considered that sort of a slap in the face not to put it in. And I'm really sorry that she's not here. I'd like to have her up here and giving us input on this bill, but I think it's not been worked out with the administration on the company line yet, so she probably is awkward to be here. But this one she was very clear on and very much wanted QCOMP to be in. And so we actually had an amendment to put it in, to link it to the formula, provided then that that we would get support for this Eiffel Tower, whether it's small or large. We did not get that support. And there was, we haven't heard too many complimentary words about this from the governor. If we do, as we go forward next year, I have told Commissioner Segrin I'm committed to putting it in. I like DuPont. I just don't like it that some get it and some do not. And if we put it in, it would be all aid. It would be $260 per pupil for all districts, and it would be linked to the formula, so it wouldn't atrophy. But, you know, I said to Mr. Segrin last night in Ricori, you know, I was raised as kind of a fighter, too. So if the governor is not going to put it, you know, give us his blessing, we'll wait for it until we put that in. So that's kind of where it is. It's kind of a discussion and an argument. And I just am going to plainly tell you that as soon as they come forward, we'll put it in and not a minute before.
Well, Madam Chair, I appreciate your frankness.
Yeah.
I really do. But, Madam Chair, another question. The length of the school year, you know, which I'm very supportive of, but won't that have to be a part of the bargaining process, the collective bargaining process, if we change, you know, and have this mandate? I mean, it's not only a mandate for the school board to consider, but won't the bargaining units also have to consider this?
Erickson, you're right. And, you know, they would have to agree or the money would sit there. It would be the current law if we put it in. So there still would be, pardon me? Maybe I misunderstood your question. Oh, the hour limit. I'm still back on hearing DuPont.
Yeah, sorry, the hour limit.
I had a blank
on
my
school year.
Only thinking you were talking about DuPont. You're talking about extended time.
Yeah.
Okay. So I didn't hear your question, but hearing what they just told me to say, I'm going to try to answer it. And if I don't get it right, you can ask it again. In fact, I'm going to ask Mr. Crow to answer it, just to be sure.
Madam Chair and members, the hours that are in the bill basically relate to a minimum number of hours that a district has to meet until it collects extended time. So if there's an agreement in place and this went into law, the only impact it would have would be on how much extended time revenue. It wouldn't necessarily have to be bargained. Now, the districts could take this into account when they do their bargaining, but really it's independent of what their agreement is. It just says, basically it says, the legislature says this is the minimum number of hours you have to meet before you can start collecting overtime, extended time funds for instruction.
Thank you, Mr. Crowe. Madam Chair, thank you. How about the choice options, you know, open enrollment, PSEO, concurrent? Are they going to show up at some other point, or are they hidden in here? Because those are factors that school districts have to consider.
Director Erickson, if it's not listed and we didn't go through it, then it's unchanged in current law. But I would ask the question to follow up on that, because you were there last night and heard this too, that currently the concurrent enrollment is the college and the schools and so forth is prorated. And so let me ask, will that not be prorated once we have this bill, since we don't specifically address it?
Well, Madam Chair, that's actually a separate categorical program for the concurrent enrollment that's part of a line item appropriation. So that will continue to be prorated unless that dollar amount is increased.
So, Mr. Strom, it's just a line item and we have to appropriate more money for it. Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair, the 1.5 under the innovation piece, everyone would get that and then choose how to use it, and then what happens?
Rep. Erickson, everyone would get it, probably. Everyone whose students are making value-added growth per whatever Rep. Mariani comes out with for the value-added growth report card, if they're making that, they would get it. And that could be a poor district in Minneapolis that has a really good school and teachers and curriculum, or that is making value-added growth. It wouldn't just follow that it's the demographics of the district. If they're not making value-added growth, and that could be Representative Benson's district, you know, if they don't have all teachers like him, maybe they're not. And so, you know, any district where they're not making value-added growth, rich, poor, you know, rural or suburban or urban, then they have to come up with a plan. And that's where we want it to be research-based, you know, per the University of Minnesota Growth and Justice, or anywhere where we have research that the department will find acceptable for their plan on how they're going to prove that they're going to make value-added growth next time, and then they get their money. If I suppose if their plan wasn't approved, they would have to forfeit that money. That's kind of silent in this bill, but it's kind of hanging in the air.
And one last question, Madam Chair. Actually, Mr. Strump, who pays the $30 million, then, of the TRA that you referenced?
Madam Chair, the way that offset currently works is back in 1997 when the legislature lowered the contribution rate to TRA, the legislature then said we're going to, since we gave districts a cost saving, we're going to reduce their general education revenue by that amount. So the loss is actually in revenue to school districts, not in a contribution to TRA. It was because the TRA contribution rate was lowered during that year. So currently all the school districts that pay into the TRA system get an offset. So that offset is eliminated. So essentially the general education revenue goes up by that $30 million per year to those school districts that were members of TRA.
Okay, members, we're going to look now, thank you, at the H4178A1 amendment that has been passed out. This is the technical amendment. Oh, it's being passed out. Even though we're not sending this bill anywhere, so this will not be engrossed, these are things that Representative McCarlin and I thought should be considered by the committee. And we wanted to let people know what they are after our meeting with Tom Melcher and Commissioner Segrin. We thought they made sense and all the staff did, and so we just want to go through them because when we take this bill on the road, we will have them as part of the draft. So, Mr. Strom, if you could just...
Madam Chair, just mainly technical things. On line 1.2, there was a mistake in the bill draft. On the ag credit, essentially, this is setting that level at 66%, not 20%, which is where we'd ended up at last year. So the 66% essentially means that on school bond issues for farm property, one-third of it would be paid by the farm property and that would otherwise be paid by the farm property, and the other two-thirds would be paid through a state credit. Then there's a couple of references to marginal costs that are eliminated. Section 20 is the framework section that's being eliminated so that there's not confusion about what general education revenue is. Then on 1.7 of the amendment, the minimum dollars per pupil, the $2,500 per pupil for compensatory, is just set it as a percentage. 33% of the formula allowance is $2,500, but this means the minimum would grow as the formula allowance changes over time. And then on lines 9 and 10, these are correcting the error on the elementary sparsity. The goal was that would be set to just 15 miles to the next nearest building. The staff development revenue essentially on line 13 is just clarifying that staff development revenue reserve of 2% continues. So, Madam Chair, that's what's in the A1 amendment.
Okay. So, members, we're not going to vote on it. We didn't move the bill, but just know that that will be incorporated. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Okay. If we get the other amendments before quarter to 11, we'll go through that as well, but it's still up there and you'll see. I said I would take Representative Grafflow before we go to testimony. We also have Representative Benson and Representative Dietrich on the list, and so Representative Grafflow, at 10 after, we're going to go to testimony, and it'll based on how much time you take is if Representative Benson and Representative Dietrich get to ask their questions. Representative Grafflow.
Well done, Madam Chair. Well done. Mr. Strom, can you just clarify? I mean, this is the first time I've seen the spreadsheet today. The special education component that Representative Heigerkin referenced, this is not in the spreadsheet?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, yes, that's correct.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Strom, so I'm looking at the third to last column when it says total increase over base. Do you have, I won't hold you to this, but an approximation, the $1.7 billion figure for new spending, I would assume it would be, obviously it's going to be higher. Do you have an approximation on what that would be?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, we're thinking that's going to be about $150 million per year or thereabouts. That amount, as you know, for each year out we go, that amount is increasing. So somewhere in the $150 million range for fiscal year 10.
And yeah. Madam Chair,
that's just the special ed portion of it. That was, yes.
That's that, okay. So, I mean, Madam Chair, Mr. Shredder, so when I'm talking about this bill, I can the $1.9 billion figure would be, I mean, that is a wag, but it's still...
Yeah, and Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, there's also the tax relief portion of it that we haven't talked about the dollar amount yet, and I think, and that's about a $600 million reduction in property taxes due to the elimination of $400 million of referendum levy and also the equity and transition levy and capital levy.
So
that's on top of the amount that you're seeing on the line on third to the last column.
Okay, I'll talk with you offline about that because I have a question about that. But Madam Chair, you had mentioned that this is scalable and that this could be put in place. Without new revenue, would we be able to put the system? I mean, I understand that we can scale it with different degrees, but without new revenue, would it be possible to put this system in place? I mean, it's kind of the step one of a long-term vision.
Representative Garofalo, that would be an interesting thing to take the existing amount of money and put it into this formula. And we haven't actually done that yet, but I would be interested. To me, we haven't gone through this exercise to change the Eiffel Tower on my desk. We're going through it to have a bigger Eiffel Tower. And if you're going to ask for more money for schools, which we desperately need, then we have to make sure we have the right formula and that we're doing things so that it's based on student achievement. And so that's why we've gone through this exercise for the matrix and also for the adequate funding. So I'm not going to get into a discussion of this being enough to do if we don't add money to it, because adding money to it is primary. And then changing the formula is to justify and make sure that we're doing it in a fair and equitable way and that we have the proportion right for our need-based formula that we're all committed to.
Madam Chair, two final points, and then I'll be done with this, is that... Madam Chair, members, something I believe in is that competition yields a better product at a lower price, and I believe that competition should be part of the funding formula that we're having. But also, more importantly, is that we heard this reference as sort of a second Minnesota miracle, and it's important that members of the committee understand what the first Minnesota miracle did. The first Minnesota miracle had an income tax rate double what we have right now. We have a 7.35% top-tier income tax rate in the state. The Minnesota miracle had a 15% marginal income tax rate. So it's important that when people are referencing the first Minnesota miracle, that we fully understand what that plan did.
Thank you, Mr. Rafflow. And we also fully understand that was a massive property tax relief. We are spending so many property taxes, and then we have the haves and have-nots, that that was the big reason for it. The Minnesota miracle was the property tax revolt. And we are getting there at this very minute. And then they also did the tax reform. And so that's why we're working with Senator Bach and Representative Lenchesky to do the tax portion of this as well. And by the way, when I discussed that we're doing the second Minnesota miracle with my daughter, who's 32 years old, she said, why are you talking about hockey, mother? And I said, that's still a good analogy because they said it couldn't be done, but they did. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to say I'm surprised I get to ask the question because you gave Representative Garofalo more power than he should have over the rest of us, but he was kind of...
Time is up. 30 seconds.
So I'm just going to throw out the question, but I don't expect an answer at the moment. And I was just looking at the number, 78% state funding now. The objective is 85%, and so a couple of questions relating to that. Is that a sufficient increase in the percent on the part of the state to in fact, provide adequate property tax relief? And secondly, the 15% that's still left over, I'd like to hear where are those funds coming from? How do the local districts take care of that? Is some of it coming from the federal government elsewhere? And if it all comes from the local district, would they not have the same problem they have now in trying to pass referendums? So we can hold that off till later.
I'm going to have, however, Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow answer the 15%, exactly what is that, so you can hear that. And then the percent, 85 or higher, We can certainly talk about that as we talk about the scalable model. That's a very good question. Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom, the 15% that's still the local responsibility, could you give us a short version of what that entails? And then while he's doing that, if Ms. Dr. Vandell could come forward.
Madam Chair and members, are you asking the dollar amount? The majority would still be the voter-approved referendum. Building would be the biggest, then voter-approved operating referendums. And then we have about 40 other categories of referendum that are a lot smaller, but include things like safe schools, building lease, integration, unemployment, judgment levy, things like that. None of them is probably greater than $20 million a year. Career technical things along those lines.
Mr. Vandell,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome, and we have with us the king of PS Minnesota, the man who reached broader than his own district to come up with a package that, you know, just like us, you know, you probably like some parts better than others, some benefit your district more than others, but yet you came up and took the notch for having a statewide plan. And we thank you for getting us started, and we appreciated having such a good document from you to start working on, or we never could have finished. So thank you, Dr. Vandell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to address you this morning. I'm almost afraid to ask you how much time I have because I've watched you manage time recently, but I suppose it's important that I do have some sense of that before I jump in.
Let's see. I'm going to just, we have 9 people. You and Dr. Dressen are our key testifiers because you are the chairs. So I'm going to say 5 to 7 minutes.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to come in today, and you referenced the King of PS Minnesota. People have threatened to crown me as the superintendent before, but that's not the connotation that they were using when they suggested that. I am a superintendent of schools for Sauk Rapids Rice, about 70 miles north of here. I have had the privilege over the course of the last 4 years, actually, to work with a growing coalition now known as PS Minnesota as we've worked along these lines. And you, as a committee, have given me quite a bit of time over the course of the last couple of years to address this issue. I heard today for the first time the reference to Eiffel Tower, and perhaps you've used that reference before, but I'm sorry if I've missed it. I have to suggest to you that I claim full French heritage, but I'm embarrassed to say that I don't know much about the Eiffel Tower. Is it a structure of form more than function? If it has function, I would suggest to you that if that function is to serve a purpose of watchtower in some fashion, I caution you to make sure as you're thinking about scaling what you're doing today that you recognize the function is incredibly important and it needs to be tall enough so that it can see over the trees if it is in fact a watchtower. Because I don't know that that would necessarily work if it's scaled so small that it doesn't accomplish purpose. The second thing I would suggest is if you're talking about scaling that Eiffel Tower, if you build a small Eiffel Tower and then wish to make it larger, you might need to tear the entire Eiffel Tower down to create a larger structure as opposed to build a solid foundation as you move up and know that you can build upon that. And I understand in working with you, Representative Breiling, that isn't exactly your intention as you move forward because the structural elements simply have to be in place as you move forward. But it needs to be of sufficient height so that we accomplish the purpose for which this is intended. Also, I have to suggest and respond just briefly to some of the questions that began to emerge because of the same kinds of questions that began to emerge as we were putting the PS Minnesota Coalition together. This is my passion, it's my profession, certainly, and what I do for fun sometimes is might seem a little bit odd, but I've been involved in a relief effort in central Minnesota and spent a weekend in the Gulf Coast this past December, also spent a weekend in Rushford and helped send several other people down to Rushford. What I've seen happen in places that have been devastated, in places that are impoverished, in places where there isn't sufficient resource, is that occasionally neighborhoods are suspicious about other neighborhoods as resources are allocated because they don't have enough to get along, and so they see something coming some other place, and they wonder about that. When in fact recovery is needed all throughout Rushford, all throughout the Gulf Coast, and sufficient resources are required. And once people reach a level of sufficiency, they quit worrying so much about what's happening in the other neighborhood because they know they have enough in order to get by. And in part, that's what's happened with our PS Minnesota coalition as it's moved forward. We have, none of us had enough to get by, and so consequently we've been a bit suspicious of resources been offered to one quarter or another. The approach that you're taking, frankly, is building a solid foundation and in fact addresses the resource needs of a lot of schools in the state, of most schools in the state, and while we might still find a particular circumstance, this is still vested in making certain that all schools accomplish what they need to accomplish. Just Minnesota grew up in that fashion. It's why groups that have disparate interests, like Association of Metropolitan School Districts, Schools for Equity in Education, and Minnesota Rural Education Association, the three founding members of PS Minnesota, have been able to sit together and to work together. While they are looking for their own interests, certainly they recognize that this initiative is vested in a broader purpose. Let's talk quickly about the three areas that brought us together. And PS Minnesota now comprises almost every major education association in the state of Minnesota, and discussions are underway with Education Minnesota about the possibility of partnership there. I spoke with Tom Dewar about an hour ago, and Tom Dewar suggests that on behalf of Education Minnesota, they're very hopeful about this, as is our entire PS Minnesota coalition. That would suggest keen interest on the part of every single education stakeholder representing public schools in the state of Minnesota. That is incredibly significant. We came together around hope. We knew that there was a better way to do this, and we knew that if we brought good people into a room together, we could accomplish things. We came together around a sense of duty. We recognize we have an obligation to the greater good, and we've worked with that spirit in mind. And we understand that we must be vested in reason. So we've tried to develop a framework that is rationally linked to our mission. Our mission is to serve kids. And what we see in the structure before us is that sense of hopefulness, something that will impact all children in a positive fashion. We recognize that you're meeting a duty, not only a duty to the greater good, but a duty to your constitutional obligation, and that is to serve the children of Minnesota. And frankly, I see it vested in reason as well, because you are doing some of what we've suggested need to be done. You've rationally assembled something. We recognize details yet to be determined, but you've rationally assembled a formula that looks at some commonalities and it looks at some differences. It bases its economics not just based on let's pull a number out of the sky, but rather in some solid research. And PS Minnesota has conducted that solid research, so we're very, very pleased that that might be the case. I understand that there will be challenges. I understand that even in the most perfectly orchestrated relief effort, there are still folks that feel like they've been left behind. While they've gotten something, they haven't gotten quite as much as somebody else. And yet they may not be able to see that what somebody else got was necessary based on that circumstance. That's where leadership is involved in rescue efforts. That's where good people standing a bit above the fray make determinations about differentiation. That's the job of a legislature. That's the job of policymakers, and I suspect that you'll move forward with that in mind. But that effort is still targeted at greater good, and that's what I would challenge you to continue to do. I also suggest that some of the questions around taxation are going to be incredibly important. And while PS Minnesota did not in and of itself position policy in that regard, we are going to stand ready to help you answer that. We're comprised of parent organizations, we're comprised of citizen organizations, and those individuals recognize that investment is required in order to accomplish what it is we need to do. And Eiffel Tower wasn't built with nothing, and Eiffel Tower was built with resource, and this is going to require resource as well. My stance today is one of hopefulness. My obligation is to serve my kids, and I'm pleased to see that you're considering the kind of resources that will permit that to happen at my local level and across the state of Minnesota. And I'm very pleased to see that what you're doing is vested in reason. I think that's incredibly important. I'd stand ready to answer any questions you might have about some of the particulars of the bill.
We're actually not going to take questions because we've got so many testifiers and we have to end at quarter two. So thank you very, very
much. Thank you so much for your effort, and I look forward to working with you as we move forward.
Thank you very much. Dr. Dressen. And the next person is going to be Kathy Buchholz. Welcome, and please restate your name for the tape.
Madam Chair, committee members, I am Superintendent Rick Dressen, Superintendent of Edina Public Schools.
And I should preface it because I assumed everybody would know, but maybe not. Dr. Dressen is the very first task force chair when this got started. He got this ball rolling until it began to look like it was going to cost money, and then the plug was pulled by the governor. So PS Minnesota funded the rest of the study and went forward. But we know that you started it, and we appreciate that. And the fact that you then were in Alexandria as the superintendent and now are in Edina, I think gives you the credibility for speaking for the state as well as Dr. Vandell. So please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have 15 years of superintendent experience in Waconia, which is a west metro suburban district, Alexandria, which is the greater Minnesota regional hub, and Edina schools. And also the good fortune of, as Madam Chair shared, chairing the governor's task force in school finance reform. In August of 2003, 19 state residents came together. We were residents that did not know each other, and we still did not send holiday greetings. But we were appointed by Governor Tim Puente and former Commissioner Sherry Yucky on a charge, and our charge was to come together. We were teachers, administrators, consultants, and board members, business directors, community members, former commissioners, and business representatives, all with one mission, and that was to say, what can we do to reform school finance? And we worked hard for 9 months on a common mission. We worked hard on our charge statement to determine if financial arrangements could be distributed equitably among school districts, if we could build a system that was understandable and linked to accountability, and if Minnesota had a database for examining school finance. And we felt we could do that, and we were able to do that through our recommendations. We worked closely with the Minnesota Department of Education, our consulting firm, Management Analysis and Planning, out of Nashville, Tennessee. The key to our report in the end was to sound the gong that 21st century education requires a 21st century funding approach, and that Minnesota could develop a model that was rationally linked, learning-linked, student-oriented, and cost-based to help education be successful 21st century. And we did work over 9 months, and we were limited in funds and time, and so we were not able to come up with an exact cost or drive down the dollars. We looked at macro numbers, and we did our work through the Freshman Judgment Panel process. But I do not want to go into the details of our recommendations. I more want to say, as chair of the committee, I want to thank the task force for their work. I want to thank this committee for your interest in hearing more about it and going deeper into the role of how funding can help support 21st century education. I want to thank the work of PS Minnesota and all those coalition members who have done their work. There is a consistency in finding, and that's so important, that we are having patterns form. I think there's great value in the fact that we were the one committee that had great diversity in representation. It was public and non-public. It was bipartisan. It was from a variety of perspectives, and yet we were able to come to the same conclusion without getting into dollars and cents that this task force found and that PS Minnesota found. I'd also like to touch on four creative ideas that were included in our report but not part of the major findings. One, we continue to encourage the possibility of doing some type of piloting of this funding formula to make sure we work out the bugs and also drive it back to an accountability component. There are ways of doing that. We also encourage discussion as it relates to reform and modifications in Minnesota Public Employee Labor Relations Act and other ways that we can look at controlling the expenditure side of the coin. This cannot be just a revenue challenge. We also encourage that the state continue to look at expanding regional services and efficiencies in greater Minnesota as well as the metro. Finally, we really continue to support the thought of innovation. And so often our funding formula is driven and takes time, and we need to be more responsive in public schools so that innovation component, we believe, was critical at our time, and we really commend the task force for making that alive. In 2003, there were many things that were not on the table that we could not see happening in public education. STEM, QComp, and the list goes on and on. I can only imagine what's about to happen over the next 18 months, the next 2 years. We need to make sure that we continue to move forward. I leave you with a final thought from consultant Jim Guthrie from MAP. Guthrie, who has served throughout the United States in looking at school finance reform and adequacy in school funding, the change in school funding for 21st century learning to occur can occur in two ways. It can occur through leadership or litigation. I believe state leadership has always been what Minnesota has been about. It's always been about leaders coming together, leaders from all walks of life, to make things happen for our young people. And I do champion that cause and want to make sure it is leadership that brings the 21st century formula forward. I have nothing against our court system, but I truly believe it's elected officials and its community members and its leaders throughout our state that can make a difference, and I encourage you to continue to pursue this cause. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. And if for you or for anybody, like I said before, the expanding regional services or how to do that part that we were charged with but didn't address, we are very open for any memos or emails or discussions on things we should include, because that was something we did not do. So thank you. We're going to hear from Kathy Buckle, who is a Stillwater school board member who has to leave shortly, and then we're going to do the amendment that we now have for the rest of the changes. Welcome, and everybody else gets about two and a half minutes.
Committee members. In addition to being the board chair of Stillwater Area Public Schools, I'm also a parent. I have a 7th grader and a 10th grader, so I speak to this from several different angles. First of all, thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here today, but more importantly, I want to thank each of this committee members for dealing with this issue. I think we all agree it's broken, and I applaud your efforts to fix it and to come up with new ways to fund the individual needs of our students. I want you to know, bottom line, Stillwater is totally behind your efforts. We are here to support you. How this affects Stillwater. Number one, we have been subsidizing full-day kindergarten for 7 years. This addresses this for us. Number two, we have a projected declining enrollment. You've addressed that. Number three, we have an increasing aging population. And the big deal with that is the recent levy campaign. We passed question one. Our community was not willing to spend a penny more. And the big thing, as we all know with the levy, is it has divided communities. It's almost a war zone. On election day, I was out with a sign, and I had people driving by and yelling at me, gesturing me, no levy. That is not what public schools should do. They should not divide communities. They need to bring communities together. It equalizes across districts. My kids are graduating from Stillwater High School and need to compete with those who graduate from Edina, Wayzata, and Minnetonka. There is inequity in the number of dollars per child, and we need that equity. We have an increase in English learning students. They cost more to teach. This addresses that. We have special ed students. There's a range of costs associated with each individual student. This bill addresses that. Overall, it increases the formula for every student. We need that. And I also want to applaud, I love the innovative revenue. I want that. I think it would be great for every school district, and I really see a link with the QCOMP program in that area. So the bottom line is we would hire more teachers. We have a college in the schools program connected with the University of Minnesota in agri-science, in animal and plant science. We have 45 kids in every classroom. Our AP advanced placement classes, the class sizes have doubled. We tried to keep it at the recommended low 20s. They're now near 40.
We have just a couple, if you could conclude in about 30 seconds.
Okay. Met with a retired teacher this week. How has teaching changed since 1973? Our high school used to be 1,200 kids. We had 15 English teachers. We now have 2,200 kids. We have 14.2 English teachers. We have one special ed teacher. We have 19. It's our biggest department. We need to fund every single individual student, and your bills are big, and we're here to help. So thank you.
Thank you very much. We have the last amendment. Is that been passed out?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't I have it? Okay. Oh, I do. Here it is. Okay. Mr. Strom, if you could tell us what this one is.
Madam Chair, very quickly, this simply is the proposal to replace the alternative facilities levy and the health and safety revenue with a single category of revenue of $600, of up to $600 per pupil, so that the department wouldn't have to make any of the health and safety calculations anymore, and there'd be a fixed amount for all of the districts. The 21 districts that that qualify for the alternative facilities would continue. Everyone else then would fall under this formula, but would have up to $600 per pupil for deferred maintenance or health and safety issues each year at the board discretion.
Thank you very much. So this will be part of our draft as we go forward, and we really like this suggestion that came from Tom Melcher to further simplify, and it makes it clear and kind of consolidate. So that was a great suggestion. Ann Maple. And right now we're going to literally have 2 minutes for everybody else. So it's Ann Maple, and then Mark Robertson, Missy McDonald, Craig Rowan, Dan Allsweiger, and Doug Conboy. So we'll get as far as we can. So welcome, and please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives. My name is Ann Maple. I'm a parent from Minnesota Public School District 659 in Northfield. I am a survivor of two successful Northfield Operating Living campaigns, most recently serving as co-chair for our 2006 effort where we passed a two-part levy, bumping our $685 per pupil operating levy to $1,180 and adding a $750,000 per year capital projects levy to help cover costs of long overdue deferred maintenance center facilities. I'm thrilled to see progress to revamp Minnesota's system of funding public schools. We need to stop making our school districts pass property tax levies just to make ends meet. Northfield, like many districts across the state, faced painful budget cuts in 2004 through 2006. We cut 14% of our budget, $3.3 million. And although we tried to avoid direct cuts to classrooms, we lost 20 teachers, many support personnel, and entire programs. It was time to go to the property owners in our district to ask for even more levy dollars. Not an easy feat in a district where the property tax that falls on individual property owners is steep because Northfield has very little taxable industry. Our levy passed, so our citizens knew that not a single program or staff cut would be brought back. Northfield is a fortunate district, yet our current class sizes of 25 to 35 at the elementary level, 30 to 40 at secondary level, are well beyond what is acceptable for effective teaching. Our student fees are going up every year. Our dedicated teachers are overworked and tired. Costs keep rising. Our PTOs and students are out in force doing fundraising. And the hard truth is that some Northfield students, especially those who are at risk, are not getting the education they need today. I dare not imagine where Northfield schools would be without the $1,180 per pupil levy dollars we have from our 2006 levy. It is likely we will have to make more cuts in the near future if increases from the state do not match the level of inflation.
Ms. Maple, your time is about up. So if you can
I'm just about done.
Okay, good.
And yet Northfield is a fortunate district in comparison to those who have not been as successful to pass levies. Here lies the problem of disparity in our state schools. My daughter, Northfield, is better off than a student in a district that has trouble generating levy dollars, and yet worse off than a student in a high property valuation district that generates more dollars than Northfield. It's not fair that today, where our student happens to live is a big part of what dictates the number of dollars available to his or her education. It's time to throw out this old funding model and provide quality, equitable education children to all children, no matter where they live in our state. Let's move forward on this Minnesota miracle, even with hockey sticks if we need to, and honor our Minnesota tradition of outstanding education, which is mandated for all of our children. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Robertson, and we certainly can listen to him. He's our current superintendent of the year. Welcome.
Thank you for, I'll try to do my 2 minute sound bite here quickly here. Here's my comment, and I want to say at the 50,000 foot level. I keep hearing, I'm new to this business, my fifth year as a superintendent, we keep hearing that there's never been a time when school funding hasn't been a crisis point in Minnesota. I know the last 5 years it's been that way for me in this deal, and we need to do it differently, and we need to show some results. And so I'm just going to tell you a quick snapshot of what has happened in Fridley, which really plays out in many districts across the state. We passed the levy, we know. We had a new levy question, which we passed and our residents voted for. We have undergone the last 5 years a transformation. We've added QCOMP, which transformed the way we look at our schools and data and so on. We have gone from AYP in our middle school to a twice nationally recognized magnet school. Both of our elementary schools have been awarded School of Excellence Awards in the last 3 years. Our high school is part of high school redesign. We added Project Lead the Way. We added math science requirements. We're getting good statistical results that are meaningful in kids improving achievement. And so while we've been in crisis, we've got after it and we haven't sat on our hands. Here's my problem. We've gotten $3 or $4 million of grants from the feds in that period of time. We've been aggressive in doing things. We've done some great things. I can tell you to come to Fridley and see what good schools can do if you apply good methodology and great effort with the staff. Our staff have made concessions. We have had them do post-retirement cuts. We have outsourced our business department. We've done all sorts of things. And here's the deal. I can balance the budget next year. We've gone up 13% in enrollment in a declining enrollment area because people want to come there. So we're doing the right things. We're getting the job done like we're asked to do. And I have one more year of where with an increased enrollment where I can balance my budget. And if we get the normal run of the mill, the way it's gone the last 10 years, I will be an SOD 2 years from now. We can't do it. And so I encourage you to keep the conversation going and to think about fundamental change, not tweaking type change. So thanks.
Thank you. I can see why you're the superintendent of the year. Thank you very much. Missy McDonald, who is an activist parent from my district, welcome. But still, you only get 2 minutes.
I'm here today because I believe in education. I'm passionate about education, and I believe in public education. And I believe that public education is the cornerstone of our democracy. I'm a parent in Roseville Area Schools. I have a sixth grader and an eighth grader. And I, like other parents, applaud your efforts to try to tackle this issue of getting funding for our public schools. I send my children to a K-8 school of choice called Parkview Center School, and we attended that school as a family because of its innovation. So I particularly applaud the idea of figuring out ways to bring back innovation in the schools that have been cut drastically because we're so desperate for public funding. My children attend a school that had a cornerstone philosophy of global education and service to the community and reducing conflict in the school. And these sorts of things are very, very hard to keep together when funding is cut. If you walked in my shoes over the last 9 years, and if you walked in my shoes today, you would sit in a math class with my sixth graders with 34 kids. You would go to their library whose media librarian has been cut. You would work on a computer that may or may not work. And how do they test these kids that are now, most of our tests are now computerized, how do they test them with computers that don't function, with money that's not there? My social worker called me 2 years ago. I contacted her only once in the last 9 years, and she returned my call at 9 o'clock at night. She was still working. If you went over to my school, you would find my principal there at 9 o'clock at night. You would find him there on Saturdays, and you would find him there on Sundays as well. You would visit my daughter's coach for an academic competition that she's in, who's given up her lunchtime every day for 8 weeks so that they could attend a national tournament, all of which was funded by bake sales.
And now need you to conclude your statement.
Okay. And so we ask why, and when we ask our teachers and our principals and our board and superintendent, we, of course, realize that their resources were limited, and that's why I asked the state of Minnesota today. I say that, do we need a miracle? Yes, we do need a miracle. We're praying for one. We're begging for one. But how is it that we've gotten to the point that the state of Minnesota, where we are asking for a miracle for basic, stable, adequate funding? And I had the good fortune last summer to take my children to Paris for 2 days, and we chose to just visit two sites because we had such a limited amount of time, and we saw the Eiffel Tower. It was my first visit there, and I can reflect on that experience. It was wonderful, and I must say that when you go to the first level, it's not a very good view. And when you go through the talk, it's really incredible.
Thank
you.
I love it that our analogy is getting better and better. Craig Rowan, and there was one name that's over here on the side that I had neglected to mention, who's after him, actually, is Tina Garup. I'm not sure, Garup. Mr. Rowan, if you could restate your name for the record.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Craig Rowan. Thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I thank the members that are here to hear our testimony. I am a St. Paul resident. I have two children in public school. I am the parent co-chair of the site council at the school. I am a board member of Parents United, which has been a coalition member of the TS Minnesota initiative. And I've also sat on any number of ad hoc committees at the district level regarding budgeting. We are here today to testify in support of HF 4178, and I commend the chair for the hard work that she has done on this legislation. We enthusiastically support your efforts. One of these members made comment about looking at this from the 50,000-foot level, and I'd like to take a brief moment to give you my perspective, which is at the ground level. Our K-12 infrastructure is crumbling, and I see it every day. At my children's school, we are forced to choose between cutting a part-time librarian or cutting a part-time nurse. We're forced to choose between cutting the allocation for new books or cutting professional development. In St. Paul, approximately 70% of all dollars go to the classroom. It's not lack of efficiency. That's not the problem. It's lack of a rational and adequate funding formula. All the while, in the last 5 years, my property taxes have doubled. And so for those of you who consider yourself to be tax hawks, what about that? Have you overlooked the fact that this has just merely been a shift onto the backs of property owners? We're paying higher taxes. This notion of no new taxes is illusory for those of us who are homeowners. So let's be honest with each other. Let's be honest with ourselves. We are paying higher taxes, but we're not using our money in a rational, constructive way. It's a hodgepodge. What we've developed in this state is essentially a Rube Goldberg style of taxation. It's inefficient, it's unfair, and it falls disproportionately on the backs of some, but not others. With this bill, if it gets the floor for vote, the public will have a chance to see who has the courage to invest in our greatest resource. If ever there was a time that your school-age constituents needed you to stand up for them, this is it. Thank you.
Thank you. Tina Garup, and then Dan Altschlager and Doug Convoy. And we do have, the House does have session at 11. We have been told to bring our lunch, our dinner, our pillows, and our computers. So members do need to get back to their offices before we get over there at 11. But I think we will be able to go until about 10 to it. Hopefully we can get everybody in. Welcome, and please restate your name.
Hi, my name is Tina Garup, and I am an Otsego, Minnesota resident. When I first started this approximately a year ago, and I was asked to work with the schools and the levy and so forth, I said, I'm just a mom. What can I do? And I realized there's no such thing as just a mom. It's the moms and the dads, the grandmas, grandpas, our young adults that aren't parents yet. All of us, it takes all of us to raise a child. We all need to come together and not just be a mom and sit back and say, what can I do? And as I said, over this last year working with this, you know, really it is me that needs to be an advocate for not just my kids, my community, but for all the kids in the state. As I said, I'm from Otsego, which is the NISD 728. The Elk River School District, and for those of you that don't know, it is the fastest growing district in Minnesota. So I firsthand see the need for funding to adapt to that growth. I also understand the need for funding reform. My school district made cuts over 5 years ago, and I don't see how we can cut anymore. These cuts reduce the number of teachers, resulting in large class sizes. We have 30 kids in our third grade classroom. We have 42 kids in our senior in our senior high science labs. They cannot even perform some of their labs because it is unsafe. We kept middle school activities in foreign languages. Only one of our high school test performing arts. This is a state that ranks third in performing artists. So it's not helping us. We have limited number of electives and AP classes in our high schools. We have seniors today that are looking at colleges and are realizing that they do not have classes that they need to enter their college of choice to pursue their field of study. And that's because we cannot offer those electives to them. So as you can see, our kids are hurting, despairingly so. People, last fall we went out for a levy to, you know, help with some of these issues. People told us, this is not my responsibility. It's the state's responsibility. The state needs, we were told over and over again, the state needs to step up and pay for the education that is supposed to be provided to them and pay for it equally and adequately.
And I'm sorry, if you could conclude.
Okay. So this is why we need this bill. So in closing, I commend all of you that put your time and effort into writing this bill. It is much needed for all of the learners in Minnesota to receive a fair and equitable education. Adequate funding is a must for all of our youth to be able to succeed in today's global society. It's time we start investing in our youth and our future. Thank you very much for allowing me to be here today.
Thank you very much. Dan Altweiger and then Superintendent Conboy. And members, Education Minnesota was not part of PS Minnesota. The thinking was that they wanted to make sure that they were looking at money for students, and of course Education Minnesota looks for that as well. But the perception, it was thought if they were included, this is what I've been told, would be then that it was money for teachers. So they were not included. They would have liked to have been. We really need them to be included now, but hence they have more questions than the other groups because they were not there, and I don't think we're going to have time for all the questions right now, but this will be a start, and we certainly are committed to working with you closely as we go forward. Ms. Altweiger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and also your education, so thank you for setting the stage. It's perfect. I don't cut out a lot of my testimony. So, first of all, I would applaud you for the work that you have done to try to find predictable, stable funding for education. That's exactly what President Dewar stated in the press conference, so thank you. There's some wonderful things here. The increase in the formula, the declining enrollment revenue, does it get us exactly to where we want it to be? I'm not sure, because rural school districts are still hurting. The referendum replacement, that's good. So I won't get into all of those. I just want to make sure the staff development revenue and all the work associated with that stays in place. I'll just name that specifically. But Representative Bud Heigergen said exactly what I was going to say. Let's get back to the T&E, the training and experience revenue. And I applaud Representative Mariani and Representative Greiling for their support for the T&E that we had before. And there are a number of the people around this table who don't know what T&E is. And I'm not going to get into the explanation so that Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow at some time can do that. We do have some questions and concerns about the location equity index. When you start working with percentages and you give some districts that have a certain general ed revenue and then you give them a 8% increase where others don't get an increase, those, when you have a larger general ed revenue and you give them a bigger increase, they're already getting a bigger increase than the percentage that somebody else would get. It's just how percentages work. And in some communities, you're going to have very little business, very little opportunity for higher salaries. And so what happens then to those teachers, and is it harder for them to get the increases that maybe they deserve? We believe that all teachers should really be starting at $40,000. Do you know that just a couple of years ago when I looked at the top salary for some of our rural teachers, it was $38,000, and it took them over 15 years to get there? We've got a lot of work to do on teacher salaries, and so we hope that that will be a part of this discussion. So I have a lot more questions about the location equity index, and this is just the first discussion. And so I would applaud your efforts in trying to make sure that we provide good funding for inner city, suburban, and rural Minnesota so that all teachers are paid the professional salaries that they deserve and our kids get the programs that they deserve as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I know you had a, I wish we could have had a lot more time with you. And just so everybody knows, the Location Equity Index, if it were not in the bill, would be a deal breaker for the chair. The bill would be pulled. But we're always willing to discuss the details of things. And then finally, Superintendent Conway.
Madam Chair, committee members, Doug Conway, Superintendent Morris Schools. I would like to first express my extreme appreciation to the chair and the committee for accepting the risk of leadership and for showing some vision. I represent a school district that ranks in the 8th percentile of funding right now on a per pupil unit basis in the state. Yet, we have the exact same responsibilities as the 92% of the schools that receive more per pupil unit funding than we do. I guess I would just like to ask you to keep in mind, if we do not go where you're proposing to go, we're saying that that's okay. And I will conclude my comments with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being succinct and eloquent as usual. Not always succinct, but always eloquent and succinct today. Thank you. Members, this is our last meeting of the session, and so I want to thank Andy and Sarah. Where is Sarah? Oh, she already went there. Well, sorry that I didn't do it sooner then, but you have been, we've had a lot of pages over the years, and you two are top notch, so thank you very, very much. I think we should give at least Andy a applause. And thank you to all the members and the staff, and we will vote on this. Someone asked, I hope this gets to the floor so we can see who has courage. This will be voted on next year. Thank you very much.